once again, the haunting strains of Mason Dixon and his Polketeers usher in Indie Week. Toe-tapping music introduces your reader, John Fetterson. It's a reading for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners for the North Carolina Reading Service. This issue is dated January the 4th of the brand new, sparkling, clean year of 2023. And here we go with our first articles. We'll start out from news that probably most of us know about, the Duke Energy rolling blackouts on Christmas Eve. Three power plants malfunctioned when instrumentation lines froze. Frigid temperatures hampered operation of several nuclear units. Energy demand forecasts failed. Nearby utilities in other states, struggling to keep their own customers warm, had no power to sell. On Christmas Eve, a multiverse of mishaps prompted Duke Energy for the first time in state history to inflict rolling blackouts on thousands of North Carolinians. More than 1,300 megawatts, equivalent to 3.6% of Duke Energy's generating power in the state, was subject to load shedding, as it's known in utility speak. These outages snuffed out holiday lights, collapsed inflatable yard reindeer, and transformed hot, aromatic ovens into dark tombs. What's worse? Duke Energy notified its customers far too late. In most cases, residents didn't know the blackouts were imminent until their TVs cut out in the middle of the Hallmark movie. On Tuesday, 10 days after the energy and public relations disaster, the North Carolina Utilities Commission summoned Duke Energy to explain itself. The inclement weather was not a surprise, energy officials acknowledged. Throughout the week prior, the utility's own meteorologist tracked Winter Storm Elliott, while the Weather Channel documented its devastation in wall-to-wall coverage of blizzard porn. Cities buried under feet of snow, whipped by high winds, dozens of people dying, temperatures plummeting as much as 30 degrees in as many minutes. The utility also knew of the disaster's inauspicious timing. Christmas weekend, when every bulb, TV, stove, holiday decoration, and electrical appliance is maxed out. When every department store and grocery is lit, vying for shoppers' last dollars. Kendall Bowman, president of Duke Energy's North Carolina operations, told the Utilities Commission, "We believed we had sufficient power, not only to meet peak demand, but with more than 2,500 megawatts of reserve wiggle room." But as the storm bore down on North Carolina on the evening of December 23rd, data showed a divergence between actual load and the modeling forecast, Bowman said. Nevertheless, as late as 10 p.m., utility officials believed there were still 900 to 1,100 megawatts of reserve in each of its two North Carolina territories. They were wrong. The events of early morning December 24 showed how widespread disaster had threatened the grid, not only for North Carolina, but also throughout the region. Bowman said a few hours after midnight on Christmas Eve, as temperatures dropped into the single digits, demand grew faster than the models showed. The power we purchased from out of state didn't show up, and the hard truth was the demand would eclipse capacity. The first domino fell in Duke Energy Carolina's territory, which serves 2.5 million residential, commercial, and industrial customers. Starting at midnight on Christmas Eve, utility officials cut back power at the Dan River Combined Cycle Plant, which runs largely on natural gas, to 360 megawatts, roughly half its capacity, said Sam Holman, vice president of transmission. This is also known as derating. Some of the plant's instrumentation had frozen, and to prevent the facility from failing altogether, operators had to reduce the strain. The Buck plant in Salisbury encountered low-pressure issues and had to be derated after the peak energy usage had passed. Officials said solar energy performed as expected, although it was not available overnight during the peak hours of 2 to 6 a.m. Another 750 megawatts of power that Duke had bought was cut and an additional 250 megawatts in non-firm, but planned purchases never materialized. Meanwhile, in Duke Energy Progress territory, the crisis unfolded at 2 a.m. Energy output was reduced at two coal-fired plants, Roxburgh No. 3, followed by Mayo No. 1. Although insulated for frigid temperatures, instrumentation had nonetheless frozen at both units, and Duke couldn't buy power anywhere from anyone. By 6 in the morning, as early risers began to brew their coffee, energy demand continued to ramp up. The ACE, an area control error, essential to a stable regional energy grid because it gauges the balance of electricity generation, was not in a desired state, said Scott Batson, Senior Vice President and Chief Distribution Officer. In fact, the situation was dire. Duke deployed an emergency alert system as required by the North American Energy Reliability Corporation, which oversees the integrity of much of the grid. Holman said, if you don't take steps to reduce load, there could be an uncontrolled loss of the system. A massive multi-state blackout across the Eastern interconnection grid. Every system operator has an obligation to the broader interconnection. At 6:14 a.m., rolling blackouts in the Carolinas territory began. Customers in Duke Progress territory had a bit more time. Their blackouts began at 8 a.m. The snafu was exacerbated by a faulty automated load shed tool that sets outage durations and prioritizes circuits to temporarily be taken offline. Duke has been using the tool since 2017, Batson said, and tested it as recently as December 12, 2022. At 6:45 a.m., 234 circuits had been taken offline. 25 minutes later, the automated tool stopped responding, requiring utility workers to manually reduce the loads. At 7:35, the Energy Control Center tripped two transmission lines to maintain the integrity of the grid. By 8 a.m., 269 circuits had been taken out of service manually. Residential and small industrial commercial customers are cut first. Power is shut off to critical infrastructure, such as hospitals and nursing homes, only as a last resort, and those facilities often have standby generators. But the process of restoring power was also fraught, according to Duke's presentation before the commission. For example, operators had to identify circuits that had gone down because of wind, then ensure they had been repaired before re-energizing them. Those 269 circuits had to be restored in sections and gradually to avoid stressing the grid. Power to customers subject to the blackout was restored by 4 p.m., Christmas Eve. And those who had lost power because of storm damage had also been restored. Still, customers were asked to conserve energy on December 25 and 26 to prevent another crisis. Utilities Commission Chairperson Charlotte Mitchell said, "Your description of the events are concerning and scary. We need to understand what happened here to protect against this happening again." Tens of thousands of customers were already out of power because of storm damage, not blackouts. Yet as Duke workers scrambled to prevent a wholesale collapse of the North Carolina energy grid, the general public was caught off guard by the blackouts. Bowman told the commission that the Duke Energy is, quote, reevaluating its communication strategy. Because of the rapidly evolving situation, Duke did not dispatch its communication plan until after the blackouts started, said Batson. This included social media, traditional media, the utility's mobile app, and the large message on the outage map, provided a customer could access any of those resources without power. Customers received no advance warning of the blackouts, Batson explained, quote, because it takes several hours to get the messages to the carriers before texts are sent out. However, in many cases, the estimated restoration times were overly optimistic, initially just 15 minutes. As the updates arrived by text, phone, or email to those who knew how to sign up for the service, the restoration times were extended 30 to 60 minutes. Duke finally exchanged the message to by the end of the day, which depending on your definition of day, could mean 6 p.m. or 11:59 p.m. Either way, on December 24, the sun has set and it's dark. The low temperature on Christmas Eve, 10 degrees in Raleigh and 9 in Charlotte, were far from the coldest ever recorded in North Carolina. Those readings occurred in 1985, when the mercury dropped to minus 9 and minus 5, respectively, even as recently as January 2018. When the state was sucked into a polar vortex, it was colder, between 5 and 8 degrees in major cities. Nonetheless, there were no rolling blackouts. Sam Holman said previously Duke was able to buy power from other utilities. This time, all of our neighbors were tight, he said. Preston Gillespie, Duke Energy's senior vice president and chief generation officer, said the utility had prepared for the recent cold snap. We recognize the need for preparation, he said. With the weather approaching, all the facilities had completed their preparation. We monitored the weather forecast to ensure there was enough generation for demand. That included 93% of the utility's nuclear capacity, 11 of 15 coal-fired power plants, and 8 of 9 combined cycle, which use natural gas. 23 of the 55 natural gas combustion turbine units switched from burning natural gas to oil during the peak of this Christmas Eve crisis, a Duke official said. Nelson Peeler, senior vice president and chief transmission officer, said that modeling from three third-party services showed the utility could meet demand. They base their forecast on known history and how the load behaves on holidays, weekdays, and certain months of the year. Saying the model was baffled by the convergence of a weekend, a holiday, high winds, and low temperatures. It didn't predict customer behavior, Peeler said. The scenario was not even seen by this model as clearly as in the past, and there are more errors in extreme condition. Peeler added, the model now has data to better predict demand in similar future situations. Julie Jansen, Duke Energy Executive Vice President and Chief Executive Officer, apologized to the commission and customers for the crisis. The utility will cooperate with federal and state investigators, she said. We appreciate how significant this is. We own what happened. Now, folks, the previous article is printed not in the print version, which came out a day earlier than this recording, and it came from IndieWeek.com, and I'll continue with the online presentation of this publication for the next article or two. And this one is about ex-Columbus County Sheriff Jody Green, who resigned last week, 6 days after he was sworn in for a second term as Columbus County Sheriff. Superior Court Judge Douglas Sasser initially suspended Green on October the 4th at the request of local District Attorney John David. The move came shortly after a 2019 phone call in which Green made racist remarks was released to the media. Green, who was first elected in 2018 as Columbus County's first Republican sheriff, resigned on October 24, at the start of a hearing to determine whether he would be removed from office. He won re-election on November 8th, beating Democratic challenger Jason Soles, who recorded that phone call. Moments after Green was sworn in on Thursday for a second four-year term, David refiled a petition asking for Green's suspension and ultimate removal. In court documents, David accused Green of corruption and maladministration in office, including racially profiling sheriff's office employees. Here's more about the allegations against Green. During a recorded phone call in 2019, he made racist comments about deputies within the sheriff's office. Here's some of what he said. I'm sick of those black bastards. I'm going to clean house and be done with it. If you ain't with me, I ain't referring to you, but if they're not with me, they're against me, and they're gone. Expletive, them black bastards. They think I'm scared. They're stupid. At least two black employees within the Columbus County Sheriff's Office were fired within 18 months of Green taking office. Clementine Brown, who'd worked with the office since 1998, the only black woman on the command staff, says she was demoted in January 2019, and Melvin Campbell, who spent nearly three decades with the North Carolina Highway Patrol, started working at the sheriff's office in 2016. He says he was fired in January 2019 by then Chief Deputy Aaron Herring, who told him the Green no longer needed his services. In an affidavit, he said he was never disciplined during his time in the sheriff's office. In an affidavit, Whiteville City Manager Darren Curry said in, quote, "Irate Green called him in late 2019 after Jason Soles, a former sheriff's office employee, was hired by the Whiteville Police Department. Green allegedly told Curry that Soles was not permitted on county property. Soles' stepfather, Jason Lee Kroom, was arrested in March 2020 after telling Green he needed to grow up, court records show. That charge was ultimately dismissed. He's accused of abusing his power in office and trying to intimidate Columbus County commissioners. In the summer of 2020, Green threatened to remove air conditioners from a school property that was being used for court purposes during the pandemic, former County Commissioner Paisley Russ said in an affidavit. The conversation occurred shortly after the Board of Commissioners declined Green's request for riot gear and larger pay increases for sheriff's employees. At a board meeting soon after, several deputies lined up in an apparent attempt to intimidate county commissioners, court records show. Also, in 2020, Green's deputies arrested County Commissioner Giles Byrd on suspicion of property crimes. An outside conflict prosecutor said the charge should be dismissed. Green is also accused of having a sexual relationship with a subordinate. The alleged affair took place between September 2019 and May 2020 and occurred during times when Green and or the employee were on duty, according to court documents. A deputy said in an affidavit, David, that the woman got pregnant with Green's child and had an abortion in Wilmington. A brutal jail beating put Green in the hot seat. After a man was being held at the Columbus County Detention Center was beaten by four other inmates last summer, District Attorney David asked the State Bureau of Investigation to look into the incident. Agents determined that jail staff failed to conduct mandatory checks, and video showed that detention officers didn't see or respond to the beating until about 20 minutes had passed, according to court records. And my last foray over to IndyWeek.com is about the new Durham bus station on schedule to get completed about 2025. It's to get a $13.5 million makeover, this article by Jenna Smith. When you arrive at 515 West Pettigrew Street, you're greeted by a glass building brought to life by the constant stream of travelers flowing in and out. Overlooking the multi-story office buildings and the red brick warehouses of the city, the station acts as a central location for local commuters to access affordable and, ideally, reliable transportation. Yet any daily commuter knows the structural failings of Durham Station Transit Center. A 2021 city report states that the station has, quote, insufficient infrastructure and resources that result in 20% of buses not showing up on time and up to an hour waiting between buses. However, change is on the horizon. Beginning in 2024, the city of Durham will embark on the $13.5 million renovation to the station. After hearing that number, you might wonder where exactly all that money is headed. The most recent proposed addition to the project, a professional services contract with the architecture firm Perkins & Will, takes $1.5 million of that grand total. The contract was unanimously approved by the Durham City Council on December 5th. Other previously approved notable expenditures include over $10.9 million for construction costs, almost $250,000 in administrative tasks, and $231,000 in public art. Mark Anthony Middleton, the city's mayor pro tempore, said about the project, "In order for a city to be a truly great metropolis, at some point it has to cross the threshold where you can negotiate the city without a car. The ability to bolster our transit system is an important step towards Durham's story of being an emergent city." The majority of funding for the project comes from a federal transit authority grant, which provides the city with $10.8 million toward the construction effort. The grant requires a 20% local match, meaning that the city of Durham will provide $2.7 million to this project. According to Amy Blaylock, a spokesperson for the city, the local match will be funded primarily by the 1/2 cent sales tax for transit approved by Durham County voters in 2011. In early 2022, while discussing the impact of this federal funding, Mayor Elaine O'Neill stated, quote, "With this federal funding, we can improve safety and customer comfort for the thousands of riders who use Durham Station every day, while also expanding capacity to run more buses, including larger articulated buses used for bus rapid transit. The new transit station is designed to be more efficient and more consistently reliable with a higher capacity for passengers. In order to gauge public support for this project, the design team consulted riders, operations staff, and the broader community. In 2011, the Freelon Group surveyed riders on what improvements would benefit their transportation experience. This survey, in conjunction with input from the Durham Station Transit Center, Go Triangle, Go Durham, the Perkins and Will design team, influenced the ultimate project design," said Blaylock. So, now that you have the grand vision for the new and improved rider experience, when can you expect to see construction wrapped up? After 16 months of design work from Perkins and Will and 12 months of on-the-ground construction, commuters can expect to experience the new facilities in full by early 2025. Well, we are now into the print edition of Indie Week, and the cover story is called "The Fate of a Food Hall," again from Durham. This article, again by Lena Geller. "Vendors first," says Adair Mueller, the owner of the Durham Food Hall, leaning against the oblong bar that anchors the hall's main dining space. "You have to think about your vendors, because if they're not healthy, the hall is not healthy." On this rainy December morning, 3 days before Christmas, vendors are indeed breathing life into the food hall, which stands at the base of the Liberty Warehouse Apartments complex on Foster Street. Balls of pizza dough sigh under flour-dusted fists, oven doors open and shut, burping out buttery wafts of cake. Chicken breasts sizzle on a flat top. Dripping umbrellas in hand, the lunch crowd trickles in. When the Durham Food Hall, a sizable operation with a slate of chef-driven concepts, was first announced in August 2018, its impending launch was met with broad enthusiasm. News outlet published features and vendor roundups detailing the hall's emphasis on environmentally friendly practices and local sourcing. Downtown Developments marketed it prominently as a soon-to-open walkable destination. But since last spring, the food hall has worn the kind of gap-toothed smile you noticed right away, with several of its vendor stations standing dark and empty. When the Indy started working to understand why so many vendors are exiting the food hall, a complicated story emerged. In dozens of conversations, vendors, former and existing, expressed frustration at legal and financial troubles, broken promises, poor upkeep, and a hostile work environment not conducive to running such a massive, multi-pronged operation, nor one that rewarded the financial risks that vendors had taken. Of the 9 former and existing food hall vendors who spoke with Indy recently, 5 say the operation's dysfunctionality either drove them from or likely will drive them from the space once their leases expire, if glaring issues are not addressed. Two vendors say their departure stemmed from multiple causes, but that their chances of staying would have been better were they afforded a more transparent, cohesive working relationship with ownership. Two existing vendors say they're content in the food hall and plan to renew leases, while two other vendors did not respond to the Indy's request for comment. Ownership of a brand like the food hall is more involved than being a landlord, but less involved than operating one of the businesses in it. This also prompts questions about the model itself. How much does a business owner owe its tenants? Do food halls, which designate vendors as independent contractors, but sometimes limit their input in daily operations, really work for small businesses? And if the food hall is driving vendors away, what does that mean for Durham? Food halls are status symbols for mid-sized cities, coaxing foot traffic downtown and helping to nurture and get small businesses off the ground. Raleigh has two, Transfer Company Food Hall and Morgan Street Food Hall. At their best, food halls, which originated in Europe and are often implemented as incubator spaces with rotating vendors, afford vendors the opportunity to pilot their concept in a budget-friendly space before committing to a full-size business. Mueller, a Durham native who first encountered the model while living in New York City during the early 2010s, says they're such a vibrant community space. Upon returning to Durham, Mueller partnered with Michael Olander, Jr., who helms the Raleigh-based firm MDO Holdings and serves as owner and CEO of O2 Fitness Clubs, to launch the food hall, which operates under the legal name Minerva Projects, LLC. Olander's firm is also a partner in BB's Crispy Chicken and Happy Plus Hale, among other operations. He was not available for comment for this story. Mueller says all signs pointed to Durham as being ripe for this type of business. So, following the takeout-only opening of the hall in May of 2020, the work of sustaining small businesses intensified as restaurants took hit after pandemic hit. For vendors who took risks in signing multi-year leases with Mueller, the pressure to eke out a success story was especially high. And at such a venue designed as a gathering place, the launch was particularly tricky. Much of the seating is communal, and the aesthetic, marked by wide front windows, funky light fixtures, and a sleek industrial finish, places the food hall in a sort of Goldilocks zone for indoor dining, where diners can relax in a space neither too stuffy nor too stark. While the outbreak of the pandemic put the communal aspects of the hall's vision on hold, the Durham Farmers Market, hosted weekly, even throughout the pandemic, at Durham Central Park, located across the street from the food hall, acted as a lifeline during what would have otherwise been a lethal dry spell for the newborn operation and its vendors, with market-goers routinely adding a smash burger or a spicy chicken sandwich to their Saturday morning shopping lists. After the hall's transition to indoor dining in April of 2021, the habit stuck, with other communities of customers filling in the gaps. With dine-in service in full swing by the summer of 2021, vendors say their concepts proved successful, including three, Lula and Sadie's, After Dessert Bar, and Bowerbird Flowers and Apothecary, who each left the space in May 2022 at the expiration of their two-year leases. The three vendors have opened or will soon open permanent locations in Durham's Lakewood, Brightleaf Square, and University Hill neighborhoods, respectively. Mueller says her operation is intended to act as a launching pad for businesses, and the departure of these vendors is a testament to the efficacy of the incubator model, saying they would never have been able to do that without the success of the food hall. While these vendors do credit the food hall for its role in expediting the launch of their businesses, they also tell the Indy that they did not simply outgrow the space, as Mueller suggests. If things had been different, they say, they almost certainly would have stayed. Construction on the Durham Food Hall began 5 years ago, around the same time most of the hall's original vendors were signing their leases. From the start, it was a gargantuan task. The 15,000-square-foot space would comprise a split-level dining area with 10 vendor stations, each outfitted with custom equipment that varied by vendor, a central elliptical bar that the food hall would operate, and an upstairs mezzanine with 3 private event venues, one of which would host another bar. Setbacks came early and often. Mueller's team of architects, engineers, and contractors were experienced in restaurant but not food hall design, and Mueller, with a business degree and a sales background, also lacked experience in the hospitality industry. Mueller says Olander Jr. is involved in strategic business decisions, and Olander's firm, MDO Holdings, provided the following company statement, quote, "We have been investment partners in the Durham Food Hall, but we're taking a deeper look into the day-to-day operations. We are committed to doing whatever is needed to provide the best experience for vendors and guests." Vendors signed on to the project in the spring of 2018 and were told the project would finish construction by December 2018. The project hit a few early roadblocks. The Liberty Warehouse building didn't enough amperage to meet the food hall's utility needs, for instance, so Duke Energy had to install new power units and lines. Delays aren't uncommon in the food world, and vendors say they were excited about the project and were understanding of the adjusted timeline. Stephen Kennedy, who owns After's Dessert Bar with his wife Lindsay, said, "I never really wanted a big 5,000-square-foot brick and mortar, and I definitely didn't want to go into the food truck route. The food hall was much more along the lines of what we were looking for, a small, casual little space to work with and get to know people in the community." Construction finally wrapped up in January of 2020, and an opening date looked promising. 2 months later, COVID-19 brought on the shutdown. At the onset of the pandemic, Mueller put a brief pause on the hall's launch, but by May, she had no choice. She says she'd been paying rent on the space for 2 years, and the operation had to open in some capacity. And on May 10th, 2020, she announced the hall would open for takeout. For vendors, launching businesses at the start of a global pandemic was not ideal. While Mueller offered to defer a chunk of their rent payments, most rents total between $4,000 and $5,000 each month, and gave them some flexibility in the hours that their leases required, she also only gave them around 2 weeks' notice to prepare for the hall's opening. Vendors scrambled, with some enacting drastic takeout-friendly adaptations of their original business models. Ex Voto, for instance, a Mexican concept whose menu originally centered around tamales and hand-ground nixtamal tamales, started serving burritos and crunch wraps. But after opening for business at the worst possible time, many vendors feel that the food hall's subsequent delay in opening for dine-in service the following May was longer than necessary. In Durham, where local COVID safety precautions were more rigorous than anywhere else in the state, the vast majority of restaurants had reopened for indoor dining by November of 2020. While vendors had the option to defer rent payments during the hall's year-long takeout-only period, the payments still loomed over their heads. The period was especially taxing for vendors who relied chiefly on foot traffic, like Bowerbird Flowers and Apothecary, a vendor that sold bouquets, trinkets, and tonics in the upper level of the main hall. Bowerbird owner Diane Joyle says, "When you're coordinating this many different vendors, it can be hard to know what to do, but I really wish that indoor dining could have started sooner." And between 2018 and 2021, while vendors were bending over backwards to earn a living while adapting to the delays, two things happened. According to court records, Gateway Building Company, the construction company that Minerva Projects contracted to build out the food hall, fully halted its work for a total of more than 3 months during 2019 and 2020. The stoppages came after Minerva repeatedly failed to pay the company for its work, Gateway alleges, and neglected to take actions necessary for Gateway to complete its work, such as procuring a gas meter. On July 30th of 2019, Gateway filed a lien, a legal claim against property that can be used as collateral to repay a debt against Minerva and its landlord, DPR Liberty Warehouse, LLC, in the amount of $97,000. The lien was canceled 2 months later when Minerva paid up. In early 2020, Minerva again failed to pay Gateway, the company alleges, and Gateway halted work. In response, according to court documents, Mueller assured the company's president, quote, that Gateway would be paid in full for all work performed on the project, and told him to stop speaking with his attorneys and finish the project. Gateway resumed work on the food hall, but after the project was completed, the company remained unpaid, Gateway alleges. In May of 2020, Gateway filed another lien, this time for $247,000. Months passed. At the end of the summer, Gateway filed a lawsuit to foreclose the lien. After the second lien was eventually paid off, the construction company voluntarily dismissed the suit. Vendors say they were in the dark about the financial issues during the delays, and several say that had they had a better sense of the situation, they may have tried to negotiate out of their lease agreements before the food hall opened. Over email, Mueller wrote that Gateway had tripled its budget for the project and she was not, quote, provided substantial receipts or reasoning as to why. As for keeping vendors looped into the process, she says she shared as much information as she could, quote, while navigating a legal dispute involving multiple private entities. Alongside the financial setbacks, vendors also were unaware of the financial assistance that the food hall received. According to public records, the Durham Food Hall received approval for Federal Restaurant Revitalization Fund, RRF grant, worth over $500,000 on May 17th of 2021. RRF grants, unlike loans, do not have to be paid back and were awarded as a way to help business owners keep their doors open. For businesses that opened after 2019 and thus could not prove losses using revenue data from the previous year, like Durham Food Hall, RRF grants were calculated by taking a business's eligible expenses, including items like rent payments and payroll, and subtracting gross receipts since opening. Mueller is cagey in response to Indy's questions about this grant, but said she would, quote, just prefer to say we got pandemic funding only because that money literally went in and out, and that it was entirely used to pay rent owed to Liberty Warehouse. Both Mueller and her landlord declined to disclose how much Durham Food Hall pays in rent each month, but Mueller wrote in an email the food hall, quote, has over $70,000 in monthly fixed costs before we even turn the lights on. While some vendors received small amounts of pandemic relief funding that they applied for themselves, they say they didn't receive any of the RRF grant money disbursed in the food hall, nor did they know about it till much later that Mueller had received it. Still in June of 2021, just 2 weeks after records show the food hall received approval for an RRF grant worth $500,000, and roughly 2 months after the food hall started its first phase of indoor dining, Mueller terminated the vendor's rent deferral period. Over the next 9 months, vendors paid Mueller back in full. While a business paying off deferred rent using a pandemic relief grant but still demanding deferred rent payments from its debtors isn't illegal, it's still questionable, according to Davy Ortz, a Durham-based accountant with experience in restaurant management, saying, I would be upset if I were one of the vendors. The majority of vendors who spoke with Indy were not aware the food hall had received a sizable RRF grant, nor were they aware of the hall's legal issues with Gateway until the Indy informed them during the course of its reporting. Most vendors found the news to be dismaying, but not surprising. They've grown accustomed to a lack of transparency from ownership, they say. Lindsay Kennedy, co-owner of the After's Dessert Bar, quote, we were not aware of the work stoppages. Obviously, if we had known about that, it would have given us a clue into the management style, a preview of the troubles that we would face later on. While Mueller was working behind the scenes to keep the food hall afloat financially, vendors say she struggled and continues to struggle to manage day-to-day operations. Harry Mons, who owns Lula and Sadie's, says, between all of the vendors, we're talking about at least a couple centuries' worth of restaurant experience. Our advice was rarely paid any attention. Even from the very beginning in the design of the space, it became a tenuous situation. Many vendors say they feel Mueller and her design team structured the space without considering the needs of tenants. The main dishwashing area, for instance, comprises just two mid-size four-compartment sinks. Mons says it becomes a real problem. There's nowhere near enough space for the dishes to get washed. And while the food hall has an industrial, high-powered dishwasher, its usage is strictly limited to customer-facing dishes, like plates and silverware, and the machine is cumulatively only accessible to vendors for a few hours during the day. Mueller says it's a continued challenge to satisfy the varying opinions of vendors, but that she has been open to vendors' feedback. Other areas of contention include the lack of space allocated to vendors, particularly in the walk-in refrigerator and freezer, and poor accessibility to the upstairs event spaces, where there's no service elevator for planners and renters to use. Lindsay Kennedy says it speaks to this pattern of perpetuating the Durham Food Hall as being part of the community, but yet you're not providing access to everybody in the community. About 6 months after the food hall opened, vendors say it became clear Mueller had not given vendors an accurate estimate of how much they would have to pay for communal cleaning staff. Vendors say they were forced to pick up the slack. During the first 6 months of service, most of the cleaning was handled by the hall and beverage directors, according to vendors. Stephen Kennedy says Mueller had planned initially on paying them like $10 to $12 an hour, and when she found out that wasn't going to work, she just passed that cost on to us. A lot of that type of thing happened. These extra costs just kept building up. Monthly operating costs for communal supplies and cleaning staff now total around $1,000 per vendor per month. Vendors say they're frustrated that those costs keep rising and the receipts aren't itemized, so they don't know how the money is being used. Despite dishing out extra funds, many vendors say they have found the hall's day-to-day upkeep consistently poor, particularly since spring of 2021 when the hall opened for dine-in service. While staff shortages have certainly plagued the restaurant industry in recent years, former food hall employees say there's a larger issue at play. Mueller enforces strict separation between the responsibilities of cleaning staff, whom vendors pay, and the bar staff, whom the food hall employs directly. Mueller doesn't refute this. That's exactly the delineation, she says. But former hall employees and vendors say Mueller's preoccupation with creating this division of work, a preoccupation, they say, with who is paying for what, has created a backwards system where bartenders are forbidden from assisting understaffed clean teams, and clean teams are barred from helping out overwhelmed barkeepers. This preoccupation is so extreme that Mueller has monitored the food hall using security cameras and scolds workers when they deviate from their assigned task, say former employees. Mons says a bartender or bar manager would go out and try to help get things clean, and they were called or texted and told, stop doing what you're doing. It's a little unsettling when you've got somebody that's constantly watching you. Mueller denies surveilling employees outside of one instance with a new employee. Former hall employees aren't the only ones looking over their shoulders. At the time they signed their contracts, vendors say they were told they could have some flexibility in their hours, and their hours were open to negotiation. But when they tried to negotiate or diverge from those hours, multiple vendors say they received legal threats. Mons, who operates Lugula and Sadie's for more hours than any other vendor during his 2 years at the food hall, for the first chunk of the pandemic, he was even open on Mondays and Tuesdays when the food hall's own bar was closed, says he received numerous legal threats from Mueller at times that he deviated from the hours in his lease. Quote, verbally, I was told that, you know, this wouldn't be a problem. But then I started getting threatened with default, because I wasn't adhering to the letter of our opening hours. When this started happening, Mons decided he would only correspond with Mueller in writing. Ultimately, the relationship became so frayed that Mons insisted on communicating with Mueller only through his attorney, he says. Over email, Mueller wrote, "The hours of operation have been an ongoing issue at the food hall, as the hours of one vendor can greatly impact the rest," and denies making any legal threats to vendors. Months after the exits of After's Dessert Bar, Lula and Sadie's, and Bowerbird, the food hall is finally working its way back up to capacity. In July, the novice vendor Little Barb's Bakery opened in the space formerly occupied by After's. In coming weeks, Mango, a branch of the Chapel Hill Indian restaurant Chola Nad, will open in the former Lula and Sadie spot, and Milk Lab, a triangle-based bubble tea shop chain, will launch where Bowerbird once stood. The three former vendors, whose operations are now taking shape in new space, describe their food hall departures as upsetting, particularly after forging friendships with fellow vendors and employees, outfitting their stations with expensive equipment, and marketing themselves under the food hall brand. Stephen Kennedy says, "I did want to stay. And if a second location came by organically, that would be great. It was never my intent to leave. I saw it as a place that we would be for a while." Mons says, "If we had a good relationship with ownership, we probably still would have gone out to another building, but we would have stayed in the food hall to have a presence downtown." Joyelle said, "I really wish I could have stayed in the food hall in some ways, but the rent was just too high." Another vendor, Old North Meats and Provisions, left the food hall last month. Its successor has yet to be announced. Old North Meats' old Joel Schroeder declined to comment on the role that specific operational issues played or didn't play in his departure, but he noted that while his business proved to be profitable, he and his business partner still took steps that allowed them to cut their original lease in half. Quote, "We wouldn't have felt the need to spend the money on lawyers to reduce our lease when we had very little money in the bank. We wouldn't have done that if we'd felt supported and kind of, you know, confident in the situations." Eric Montaigne, on the other hand, still has a few years on his local's seafood lease and says he doesn't see any reason why he wouldn't renew it. Quote, "There's issues everywhere. We opened in one of the most stressful periods in modern history, and so I kind of take things with a grain of salt. I really enjoyed pushing on past that." While other vendors agree that the operation is running more smoothly than it once was, several say that things have only improved because Mueller no longer has day-to-day contact with vendors, and some of the issues detailed by former vendors and former employees are ongoing. Vendors who spoke with the Indy emphasized that the food hall is a fantastic concept, one that truly belongs in the heart of Durham, but feel it needs nurturing in order for existing and future vendors to thrive. Otherwise, they fear the operation may become a black eye to the city, an incubator space with the opposite of its intended effect, driving bright-eyed novices with creative concepts to leave the industry entirely. All right, and Jasmine Gallup from Raleigh reports now in the Raleigh Police Department. Last year, Raleigh police shot and killed two people in what many advocates argue were preventable incidents. This year, the department has introduced a de-escalation policy designed to prevent deadly confrontations between officers and civilians. The RPD's new de-escalation policy took effect late last year after the department hosted a series of listening sessions to get input from criminal justice advocates and the public, a process the city's black communities continually pushed for following these shootings. Last year in January, police shot Daniel Tercios, 43, five times in front of his wife and two children. Body camera footage revealed Tercios, who didn't speak English and couldn't understand officers' commands, was trying to walk away from police when he was first tasered in the back. Then in May, 37-year-old Ruel Rodriguez Nunez was killed after police opened fire with more than 30 rounds following a confrontation outside a Southeast Raleigh police station where Rodriguez Nunez was throwing Molotov cocktails at police cars. Body camera footage revealed that though several of the police officers surrounding Rodriguez Nunez were trying to de-escalate the situation, ordering the man to stop and take his hands out of his pockets, one officer goaded Rodriguez Nunez into continuing his attack just before police opened fire. Statements from Rodriguez Nunez during the incident and from family members afterwards suggested he was in a crisis and was attempting suicide by cop. These shootings are part of a larger pattern of use of force by Raleigh police, advocates argue. Kerwin Pittman, a policy and program manager with Emancipate NC, says he wants to see the RPD's attitude shift from a warrior mentality to a guardian mentality, saying, de-escalation can't be true de-escalation if you're approaching the scene as if someone is combative and you actually have to eliminate the threat. You have to approach it from a public health standpoint. Once you adopt that mentality, then you can roll into what actual de-escalation looks like. It's taking time, slowing down the situation, but also, most importantly, de-escalating themselves. Officers have to take their feelings outside of this and lean into their training. De-escalation and how best to achieve it has become a popular talking point over the last few years as advocates push for police reform. Essentially, it means that instead of going straight for their taser or gun, police officers will first try to talk to people or communicate nonverbally. They may keep their distance, preventing a need to react to threats. They'll do what they can to eliminate the need to use force. RPD's de-escalation policy follows this pattern, requiring officers to, quote, assess the level of noncompliance and determine whether there is an immediate need to act. A need to respond immediately without attempting de-escalation could be brought on by an imminent threat of safety to the officer or others, destruction of evidence, or a medical emergency, among other factors. The policy also directly addresses scenarios like the ones in which police shot and killed Tercios and Rodriguez Nunez. Per the policy, officers should consider whether a lack of compliance is deliberate attempt to resist or is the result of an inability to comply, perhaps due to a language barrier or other factors, including physical limitations, developmental disabilities, or a mental health crisis. In addition, quote, an officer should not antagonize or bait a subject to act in a manner that will reasonably result in an unwarranted escalation, states the policy. Is the policy good enough? The RPD's new policy is a step toward police reform, but some say it doesn't go far enough. The final policy lacks specific detail and is open to misinterpretation by officers, argues Pittman. He's concerned officers still won't be held accountable for their use of force, even with the new policy in place, saying, when a policy lacks specifics about how you're supposed to operate, it leaves room for a lot of error. It leaves it up to the officer's interpretation, and we know when they lean on their own interpretations, as we've seen in the past, they make mistakes. With de-escalation, you have to get it right. One time getting it wrong could cost somebody their life. The devil is in the details. If you have something that's not descriptive, it's a recipe for disaster. In an open letter sent in November, Emancipate NC requested 9 changes to the draft policy based on the strong de-escalation policy that the Seattle Police Department uses, which is modeled on a policy from the Oregon State University Department of Public Safety. One request was that the RPD include, quote, specific, descriptive, and step-by-step instructions for officer communication in a de-escalation scenario. For example, an officer could be instructed to acknowledge the individual's feeling or caution that warnings given as a threat of force are not considered part of de-escalation. Emancipate also asked the RPD emphasize the use of force should be a last resort and set stronger expectations for how officers must attempt de-escalation. Attempting it as a priority only when time and circumstances reasonably permit is too vague and lends itself to willful misinterpretation, states the letter. The RPD didn't respond to the proposed changes, according to Pittman. He says he's disheartened by the department's lack of response to community input. If you're going to come to the community and ask for input but not take it into real consideration, then what was the point? The department has indirectly addressed some of the concerns, specifically regarding de-escalation training and the ability of the department to ensure its officers are using de-escalation techniques. Annual training is required for all employees per the new policy. That training will include specific examples of techniques based on the curriculum of the North Carolina Justice Academy. That's a training facility run by the NC Department of Justice under the oversight of Attorney General Josh Stein, according to Goodwin. The policy also includes a provision that supervisors should assess ongoing de-escalation attempts and monitor employees' use of techniques. That provides for an additional level of accountability for officers, according to RPD Captain Eric Goodwin. Well, I must curtail my reading of Indie Week for this week, even though that article is not finished, and I've had to forego several music art-related articles to provide more news, as I usually do. But you can go to IndieWeek.com on the Internet and get up-to-date articles, versions of these articles, and even new articles between now and next week's reading from Indie Week. And I'm turning up the volume. Mason Dixon's and his Polketeers have been playing up a storm outside our studio. In fact, our entire staff I see barging up and down the carpeted halls, polkaing away. And I just wish everybody a happy new year. It's the first time I've been on the air since we've the holidays. And we'll be back next week with Indie Week.